one-tenth portion of 24 hours. And every time we are away from this level and working through with the energy in the lower aspects of the body, we are dissipating the energy. We are draining it out. The human body is a result of the last karmic debt in the last life. And the only reason you're alive is because of that unfinished debt. So the body is already programmed by you to eat a certain quantity of food. It's programmed to breathe a certain quantity of air. And it's programmed to perform a certain amount of motion. And it's set up like Russian roulette. Anytime one of these three comes up first, you cash in. And that is factual as it will ever be. And that's the essence of the whole purpose of the human body. Any one of these three that comes up first, if you breathe out all the breaths that you're supposed to breathe, by what you program into it, you check out. If you eat up all the food you're supposed to eat up, it checks out. If you perform all the physical actions you're supposed to perform, it checks out. We don't own the body. It's given to us by virtue of the karmic debt. The life energy is the only thing you are. And it passes through this physical body. It works. It's connected to it by sound. We identify it by word or idea. We label ourselves all types of things. But when it boils down to realizing ourselves, it's involved with repetition. So when a person says, I'm going to meditate, he doesn't even begin to realize what he's getting into. That he's taking on the biggest challenge of his whole existence. To bring this consciousness to a state of alignment with his conscience. And once you align your consciousness with your conscience, you have begun the road of self-realization. Not until that time can you really go on to God-realization. God-realization the saints have. Self-realization is what the disciples have. When the disciple reaches God-realization, he too becomes master. So we find there's a vast difference between the two. The master is always in that state. He's in that state consciously from birth to death. He doesn't leave that state. The disciple is not conscious. He searches for that state. He gets glimpses of it. He fluctuates back and forth and discovers occasionally that the reason that he's not getting into that state is the karmic debt. The mind is not steady. He's incapable of keeping the mind steady. When Jesus said, when thine eyes are single, he meant when the mind also is steady and don't fluctuate. Because the mind has a tendency to drift. It will only drift in the three gunas, or the three modus operandi of the energy. That is past, present, and future. Can't move anywhere outside of the time cycle. It's a slave within the time cycle. So it will stay in that and drift back and forth, either drifting into the past or drifting to the future or stay in the present. And these three forces are constantly imposing their supremacy upon this life energy. Once you begin to recognize this control that you're under, then you have to start the process of breaking free from it. And the saints tell us the only way they can break free is the consistency of repeating or hallowing the name or performing japa or simran. When you see individuals twirling their rosaries for long hours, you begin to see a science at work in harnessing the five senses for the first time. In a very simple way. The consciousness of the master is that individual who has taken that technique to the point where his whole life energy has synchronized with it. Early in the day I said there was a man who sang a chant. It was called Dawatmaya Life. The words are very significant and the intimacy is significant. And the man who sang that chant, from the time he sang it, sang no other chant all through his life and attained complete God-realization. His name was Narada, the saint that walks around with a veena across his shoulder. He is the author of the song, and that song is named after him. He sang no other song while he was in the body, and he sang it in every language possible that he went. He'd come into a place, never knowing the people, and just hearing their language for a brief moment, and then he began to sing the song in that language. His God realization was so strong that the one song was heard throughout all India, in every language the people that spoke at the time. Now they say in India there are over 722 different dialects. So you can imagine the one song being sung in 722 different dialects by the same one man. But he didn't sing anything else. Yet his God realization was the result of singing that one chant or mantra all his life. His presence was alone to control the elements. Plants responded, they were healed by his presence by just singing the song. The sick got healed. Wherever he went, he just sang the song. In whatever language he found himself, he sang the song. So here is the essence of what Japa is, or Simran, or hallowing the name. It's a consistent repetition of the vibration. Those who've been exposed to the Hare Krishna movement will see the same thing. They chant their mantra over and over. And you don't stay too long in their vibration before you find yourself wanting to chant. Either they gain control over the environment or you run. But rest assured that they have brought their environment under control by their consistent chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. And they will take the lousiest area and sit down there, one, two, or three, and they will chant. And before you know it, that area will change. The vibrations will change because they will never allow the environment to dominate them. Anyone who has actually learned to do it begins to change from inside. And you think these people are fanatics, but the great masters all said they have such devotion that they have broken the ice that would lead them to God realization. They have broken through to self-realization. One time Master Charan Singh was in Hawaii and he saw them chanting, and then he said, tremendous devotion, they have broken through to self-realization, now they must go inward to get to God realization. So if the very first step to self-realization is to break that particular frequency, and they have done this by chanting, then you can realize when a spiritual person gets on the path in his own way, he knows where he's going. He takes the mantra inside and he starts chanting it or repeating it to the point where his whole frequency starts to involve his whole being. And then he's ready now to jump off into the ocean of God realization. It's difficult for many of us who have found other methods and think they work to suddenly find we have to come back to this method. But the scriptures point it out in the final summation, and that's where we have to go for the evaluation. The real evaluation, we have to go to the scripture. We have to go to the saints, because they are the ones who see the perfect plan of this whole creation. They are in that state, and not everybody can be called a saint. And I don't mean one that is canonized by the church. A living saint is one was in full control of the audible life current by his consciousness. He alone can say to the world, "No man take my life from me. I have the power to lay down. I have the power to pick it up." While he's in the body, he has this quality. He alone in the body can make such a statement. Not a dead saint, not a dead person, but a living person who must be in full control of not only his physical frame, his electrical body or astral body, his ideational body, and on that physical level, he alone can make the statement without any doubt in his mind that he can lay his life down and pick it up, and no man take it from him. No man can actually take the life of a saint by any unwitting act. The saint has always that power to lay it down voluntarily or pick it up by divine command. He is in total awareness of it. How did he get there? That's the principle that we're concerned, and the simplicity of the principle. Hallowing the name of the Lord and loving his neighbor as himself. These two principles or techniques are the only thing the saint lays great emphasis on. Everything else tries to reinforce those two. Anything else you teach us is to reinforce in our minds these two concepts, these two techniques. Repetition of the holy name, or hallowing it, loving your neighbor as yourself, and that is doing the will of the Lord. Doing the will of the Lord is to accept wherever you are as the right place, at the right time, and the experience you are confronting is the right experience, and the experience is only to test your love. There is no good or bad experience. There is no good or bad experience. It's all opportunity to test love. Test the attitude of love. And that is the will of God. It's not somebody out in space pinpointing and pushing you. You are in time and space already. You are involved in confrontation, action. But that confrontation is to challenge and to test the inherent love of your nature, and that is your fellow man who is going to challenge you. As the old man once said, this world is a beautiful place except for the people. And the saint says, this is a beautiful place because of the people. It's only because of people that makes it beautiful. It's only because of souls moving through the world realm that makes this place a challenge for God's realization. Otherwise there is no challenge. Otherwise there is no God realization. If another human being never came into your periphery, you will not know how godly you are. You will live under the ego that you know it all. You think you have all the accomplished all there is to do. But until another human being comes and finds a loophole in this armor of ego and start boring at it, then this is your trip to your own nature. And that is where the real love is. The real love is this confrontation. One more thing about Simran. Do not do it mechanical. Do it with love. Just sit down and mentally hallow the name. For those who are initiates, you have the name. For those who are not, Father, I love you. It's a very good statement. Sanskrit words are difficult for Western minds. For some, it's okay. For others, it's very difficult. English, to which we are born and grow up, generates an intimacy and an understanding. So as I said before, it's not so much the words. If you said, Father, I love you, it would make no difference. Or if you said some Sanskrit term, Om Mani Padme Om, or anything else. The idea is that you got to repeat it. Hare Hare Krishna, Hare Hare Rama Rama. Whatever it is, but repeat it. The paddle does not make the butter. It doesn't change the cream into butter. It's the good old churning, elbow grease. Now the first time I heard the word elbow grease, I went to buy it. So I know there was no way I could buy it but work my brain. Same thing with us inside. To spend the time to test it, to bring that state into manifestation. Do you have any questions? If we do what? Yes, you are at the right place and it is the right time and the experience is the right experience for you on a conscious level. This is already programmed by you in your past that you were going to fast. You don't just come along and want to do it because others are doing it. You suspect somewhere along the whole process to ensure all these things. So you go ahead and program within yourself that you're going to fast. So one morning you wake up and suddenly you find an urge to fast. This is already programmed or else you wouldn't want to do it. This is the built-in insurance and prolonging of the existence. But you're still going to live through that experience, you're still going to have to work it out. So you are giving yourself time by building in all these already. But you don't realize that you did this. You see, it's like this machine here. When the designer designed it, he built every possible concept he could before he turned it loose. But after he turned it loose, he couldn't change anything no more. That's the way it's going to be. Because everything is already set up in his consciousness. The architect, the model, that is where everything is set up. The finished product is nothing. Any mechanical man can put the finished product together. But it's the man who has to conceive this whole thing. This man has built in all there is to build in, that his mind would permit him to build. Equally true, when the Creator designed this body of ours, designed this whole universe, he set up all there is. Now when we come along by virtue of karma and violate these laws and want to remodel it and start it all over again to correct it, we implant, like the Creator, all the possible combinations of compensation. So when we begin to live it now on a factual level or a physical level, all these thought patterns come up to the surface and therefore we will find ourselves programming, acting, fasting, possible minimizing our action. We run in with the concept of renunciation, no attachments. All these things are all programmed in already to minimize and lengthen the time span in the body. We have done set these things up, we're just coming back to them on a conscious level, but it's already programmed in from the level of concentration, from that idea pattern. We've put it there already. Just to realize it.
Does that mean that you've been programmed to get as far spiritually already?
Yes, but you don't know it. Why you don't know this? Because you have shut it off yourself. Nobody shut it off but yourself. A saint is only a man who realized the total thing, who came back to the total realization of what he had done to himself. And therefore they call him God realized. He has a total memory of everything that is going on. That's what God realization is. Total memory of the whole plan of the existence.
Then are we not all capable of doing this because of our past karma? We're just not capable of doing this.
The past karma is the filter between your memory and the experience. If you were capable of lifting this karma, the whole total memory will come back.
But what I'm saying is, though, because of the karma that we come into this lifetime, that some of us may be able to burn it all out in one lifetime, and some of us may not.
That's right.
There's no control of it.
We have no
conscious
control. So you yearn to break that, otherwise you would not yearn to break it. And by yearning to break it, who do we go for the instruction? We have to go to someone who has broken it. We go to a saint, one who has broken this particular limitation upon our consciousness. And he gives us the practical key. He says, hallow the name. That is to take the sound, which is bringing in the energy, which is the audible light stream, and lock onto it by repeating the name and pull yourself out. Now there was an Englishman who didn't know of this particular presentation of the technique, but he did the same technique in spite of it all by repeating his name backwards. You know who that man was? His name was Lord Tennyson. He made up his own mantra by repeating his name backwards, and he used to go into states of realization. Finally, one day he did enter God realization by repeating his own name backwards. We found out that when they told him as a kid, a good Christian is one who always hallowed the name of the Lord, one who prayed unceasingly. But he was a rebel. He didn't want to be a Christian quack, he said. So he didn't want to repeat Christ or Hail Mary or something like that. In those days, when Lord Tennyson was alive, the Catholic Church was strong in power. And he, being a good Protestant, didn't want to be caught in the ban. So he says, I use my own name. By virtue of repeating his own name, he broke through. So you see, some of us can figure this thing out and get out too. So it's not the words we use, it's the repetition. Now if you know your own name and you want to make a mantra out of it, repeat it backwards, it'll sound like Sanskrit. See, many of us have our names, repeat them backwards. It'll sound like Sanskrit, it'll give it a nice tongue twisting, but that'll help your mind to pull. That is what is involved, the consistency of the repetition. It breaks the pattern. There is an interesting thing to see how your mind is conditioned. S-U-C-H, how you pronounce it. You're trained to pronounce S-U-C-H as... Now, H-C-U-S, how you pronounce that? H-C-U-S? You see how your mind is bamboozled right away to pronounce that same word backwards? Here it starts to figuring it, can't associate. Do you see the rut that the brain is in? From the constant programming as a child to right up to this present moment of repeating S-U-C-H as, and now to say H-C-U-S as what? Now if you started off as a kid pronouncing H-C-U-S, by the time you get to be an adult, you would not be able to say S-U-C-H. You see? If right now, as an adult, you're saying S-U-C-H and calling it a certain name, or giving it a certain sound vibration, just to reverse it and say H-C-U-S and pronounce that, you see how the mind is struggling to associate H-C-U-S. you can't seem to give it some sense of balance, some type of association, nothing that is intimate in that sound. Now supposing that is a word in Russian now, and you're going to learn to speak Russian, and then you see it written at the start of a sentence. Do you see how you'd have to start retraining yourself even to pronounce? So, because the brain is programmed in to act certain accepted modes of the alphabet, and to make those sounds as a child to be to an adult and identify with it to the extent that you may even want to give your life for it. This is what we're talking about in the sankharas. This is what we're talking about when the consciousness is trying to identify with the spirit. So how to take the sounds and change their patterns back and go in. So imagine men like Narada singing, "Thou art my life," in so many different languages. His brain had to be attuned. He had to break the patterns to which we are crystallized in. So when the mind is flexible, the greater the flexibility it has, we are seeing for the first time a spiritual person. When that person is flexible inside, for the first time we're seeing spirituality. There is no rigidity there. There is no shutting down. There's constant flexibility going on. Well, tomorrow morning we have a meditation in the chapel, and as I said, the biggest challenge is your simran. All the masters teach us only two things: simran and bhajan. They don't teach happiness. Simran is repeating the holy name, and bhajan to listen to the sound current in your body, the ultrasonic frequency. They have nothing else to offer the world, because what is man but a composite of ultrasonic waves and light waves? The ultrasonic waves passes through the right side of the brain, and the light waves pass through the left side, and they filter themselves through ether, with the head, air, with the chest, or the gas, thermal, which is the intestinal tract, or fire, water or fluidic, which is the semen, earth, which is the solid mass bone, base of the spine. These are the chakras they talk about in the yoga. They're talking of these five forces, and they're talking of light and sun. So they say we have seven chakras, or seven force fields of energy passing through the body, making up this whole body. We have sun, we have light, we have ether, we have air, we have fire, liquid, matter. When Nanak was alive and he had mastered himself, Guru Nanak only lived about 500 years ago, and he was trying to help the Hindus and the Muslims to stop their fighting among themselves. And one day he was lying down with his foot facing the Hindu in the Muslim chapel, in the altar in the chapel. And while lying down like that, he was in a deep state of oneness. And out came out the fakir, priest, and looked at him and said, "Infidel, unbeliever, sacrilege, desecration to our temple." So he got some big sturdy guys to take Nanakam turn his foot around and put his head to the altar. You know what happened? As he turned Nanak's body, the altar started to follow Nanak's foot. Every way he turned Nanak, the altar followed. He didn't go up. So the priest was puzzled. He said, "This must be a great spiritual man." Then he opened the eyes and he said, "Who are you?" And Nanak said, "I am a man of five elements." Later on, when he was in the Hindu place, again he performed something that the Hindu didn't accustom to. And when he was ready to die, and he did die consciously, they put him in a coffin. They sealed the coffin. But then the Hindu and the Muslim began to argue as to the way they should carry on the funeral of Nanak's body. The Hindu tradition was to cremate the body. The Muslim tradition is to bury the body. So they began to argue now over the dead guru's body. After a long while, the lid of the coffin flipped off, and Nanak stood up and looked at them and disappeared in front of their eyes. And he left in the coffin two bunches of roses. The Hindu, by their tradition, took and cremated their roses. And the Mohammedans, or Muslims, by virtue of their tradition, took theirs and buried it. The coffin is still there today. Nanak is not there, but the war is still going on. Man didn't change. Tonight we're talking again about meditation and nutrition and how they go together. Spiritual life. It is organized to work with food on all levels. And the only way we can really make the progress is by organizing the diet. We can only go so far in our spiritual progress by certain types of foods. Then we get bogged down. To go beyond that level to the highest experience, we have to go strictly back to a natural food diet. Very simple. And more of the etheric nature. That would be the fruit and the vegetables. As we meditate, the mind drifts away. And the drifting of the mind is down into the five forms of energy passing through the body. It drifts down to the earth energy, the water, the fire, the air, and the ether. According to what you're eating, that again, your mind starts drifting and locating itself in the body. The ether is from the neck up. These are the etheric waves. From the neck down to the navel is the air, the gases. And from the navel down to the groin as the fire, and the groin, the sacrum, that is the water, and at the base of the spine down to the feet is the earth. And those foods that are very earthy are your root vegetables, and they tend to keep you down in the earth plane. Nature did not intend us to eat too much at night, therefore she grew them under the ground in darkness. So those foods are very limited. You have a very small source of supply of vegetables that grow under the ground in darkness. They draw from the earth plane. Therefore the consciousness will be drawn to that level. When we minimize the intake of them, then we rise into the water level. The water level is like your fruits that grow on the surface of the ground, your melons, your cantaloupe. They have a large percentage of water. Your leafy vegetables, they're all in the water level. Then you come up towards the grain. That is in the fire region. They require a great deal of digestive power to break them down. The grains. So in the middle of the day you eat the grains to break them down when the heat of the day is very high. So the consciousness is rising up into the heat. And when we go up into trees now, we find we have the fruit. They are in the air. Sometimes you find grapes growing on vines, they're climbing into the air, and your sunflower seeds and fruits that hang from the tree. And finally, but those that go very high is still fruits, the etheric nature. So the more fruits you eat is the more etheric the nature of the person becomes, the more the consciousness rises in the etheric realm. And the meditation rises all the time because those elements are pulling you upward to the eye center to keep the brain up, keep the mind up in the point between the eyebrow, and don't let it drift down. That's why you find when you're meditating, the more light food you eat, the more fruits you eat in their raw nature, the more the meditation seems to soar and get deeper and deeper. Yes. Nuts, it's in the archetypal pattern of the plant, and therefore it's in the etheric nature. See, the fruit itself is the meat, and that is the air, also part etheric, but the seeds and the nuts in the plant itself is the archetype, the very pattern of which a thing is formed from. That's the ether, that's the etheric nature. And the more of that you eat, the more of the archetypal patterns you are drawing down. You're familiar with Carl Jung's work, The Archetypal Patterns of Men. So in order to live in that ideational realm and be more familiarized with it and to stay up in that level, it is the ingestion of those substances that carry the archetypal pattern that nourishes the spiritual body. Therefore, your food is important to your meditation. It's already designed by the creative intelligence. We did not make it, we just merely synchronized it. Now, in the etheric realm, two forces are predominating: sound and light. Every plant is bombarded by sound waves in the atmosphere, and it's bombarded by light of the highest frequencies. And the sound current passes through the human brain on the right side, and the light passes through the left side. And this makes a polarity of seven. The seven centers, the seven forces of energy, are known as chakras. They are working through you. The sound current passes through your right side, and the light passes through your left side. and they have to merge at the point between your eyebrows. So when we use the word chakras, we're not talking of the oriental idea of a bunch of petals. We're talking of factual things as they really are working in the body. These are forces that are passing through from the elements themselves that make up the body. The earth center is your first chakra. The water center is the second. The fire center is the third. The air is the fourth. The ether is the fifth. Sound is the sixth. And light is the seventh. So you have sound on the right side and light on your left side. So you return back to the sound currents. You have to listen to the sound currents. That's why when you practice your meditation, you have to identify with a sound. You have to be able to put some sound in the mind to make it work. That's the purpose of hallowing the name of the Lord, or the purpose of repeating something. So when you meditate and close your eyes and keep it at the point between the eyebrows, and you begin to do your japa or your simran, that is to repeat some word in the brain, you are identifying with the sound currents, which are the ultrasonic frequencies that passes through the right side of the brain. Now, the more you repeat, the more you identify. The more you identify is the more realized you become. So meditation becomes a very simple process, but results can only come from the constant doing of it. It does not come from reading books. It does not come from lectures. It comes from hallowing the name of the Lord and listening to the sound currents and seeing the light inside in order to perceive the radiant form of the Master. This is the actual practice that is intended when two or three are gathered in my name. There am I in the midst. My name being the Christ intelligence, the Master consciousness. Two or three gathered as two individuals sitting in alignment with the sun current passing through the right ear and identifying with that sun current in order to see that radiant form within the eye center. The radiant form is there, and none can get up from the level of the ego to full God realization unless they pass through the third eye center through the radiant form, which is the Christ intelligence, back to that pure state of being. Any attempt to get into the pure state of being outside of this approach is futile and it doesn't work. We're only going around in circles and making games of the mind. The saints have come and gone, and they keep coming back, and they all point out the stress that realization is based on going inward. It's based on aligning with the light, aligning with the sound, and seeing that radiant form within the light, which is the Christ intelligence, and passing through that radiant form into God realization. The moment you begin your meditation and you begin to hear the sound, you are stepping into self-realization. And as you listen to it and you repeat the name or hallow the name, for beginners who say, Father, I love you, which is very good, because it's a very intimate way of saying it. It's in English, more so than Sanskrit words. This intimacy leads you to self-realization. And finally, as that song breaks through, and you begin to see the radiant form, you're entering into God realization. And in God realization, with eyes open or eyes closed, you will see the radiant form all the time. And that is the end of the meditation. That's the culmination of your growth, because you and the radiant form have become one and the same. You and the Father are one. You know without doubt now that God has become you. You live in this world fully by divine law. Now this is a hard part for us to accept, because who can say who is more God-realized than the other? No one can say that. Only the God-realized man knows that. But he doesn't tell you. because he is perceiving this whole picture in his perfect nature. And he's not condemning a single thing as it occurs from that level of God-realization. Only we who are in the process of becoming self-realized can criticize, can make all kind of mistakes. We are the ones who make all the ifs and doubts and the buts and maybe and could be, because we are in the process of self-realization. But when we achieve God-realization, seeing the radiant form completely, there is no ifs, but, or me, or maybe. It is all one. There is a difference, because in that radiant form, you become the process. It is a process, and meditation is a process of unfoldment from a state of self-realization to God-realization. From a level of ego to a level of pure being. When we realize this, we see that the human body was designed primarily for the soul to gather humility, that a soul lives by divine will. The soul has no free will of its own. There is no such thing as a free will. We are living according to divine law. But the ego, the mind, the consciousness, will try to entertain the thought that it is running and operating its whole machinery, and to pre-conquer the thing before it comes into existence is to pre-arrange it. Therefore you have no say in the matter of how many hairs you have on your head. You can't add one to it, you can't take away one from it. You're already set up in number, and that's what they'll be, till they fall off or continue to grow longer. Now, if you say you're going to add more hair to your head if they fall off, you're not adding after they fall off, because you don't know how many you had in the first place to start with. See? And if it doesn't fall off, you don't worry about adding hair to it. And if it does fall off and you want to put hair in it, you wouldn't know how much to put back. So you don't know the number, because you never have to count it. So free will is an elusive condition. It's only something that the mind is working with. Now, we are forced to realize through our meditation the humility of the spiritual life. He that do the will of the Lord is my brother. That's humility already. He that followeth in my words is my disciple. That's humility. So this shows us we have no free will, but we entertain the thought and we struggle to exert some initiative in our affairs. But this is all karmic. The affairs of our lives are already set up for us to work it out. And in spite of our good intentions, we are pushed along towards our destiny by the love of God to face it. And we will make it in spite of ourselves. This is another interesting law about the life. We may think we will not make it and we will get into all states of frenzy. Yet, in spite of ourselves, in spite of our ego nature, our personality makeup, we will get to that particular level of experience designed for us, destined for us, by divine will. Even Master Jesus knew this when he said, "Father, remove this cup, but not my will, but thy will be done." My will is the ego will of the flesh, the body, craving to block out the experience. But divine will is the confrontation, the actual living out of the experience. We can presuppose many things in our minds, but not until we live it and go through it do we realize that it's all law, all divine principle, it's all set to happen that way. Now, once it's finished and happened, it may not be to your liking. And you may say to yourself, I wish it turned out different. But if it was going to turn out different, you would have had it. And since it didn't turn out different, you don't have it. So the mind plays this game. If I had a second chance, I would have done better. Given a second chance, it may not do better. It may do exactly the same thing. There's a story in the East that says a certain man was carrying a bag on his back. It's very heavy. And he came to the temple of Shiva. And he said to Lord Shiva, why do I have to carry such a big burden on my back? I would sure like to carry a smaller bag. So the statue in the temple spoke and said to him, before my feet there are many bags of various sizes. Pick up the one you think you can carry, and it's yours. So that made the man very happy. He put down the bag that he was carrying and began looking around. So he picked up the smallest one, but he couldn't lift it off the ground. He went to the next smallest, bigger than that. He couldn't lift that. And after about an hour trying each bag, he finally ended up picking up his own bag. It was the only bag he could have picked up. So he said, how is that? Then the statue said, you see, your burden was already weighed out for you according to your shape and your form and all your conditions. So now carry it and don't argue. Our life patterns are already programmed in, like this recorder. The architect, the designer, programmed the circuitry before it was put together. And that's the uniqueness of the divine principle. Our mechanism, our karmic relationships are all set up from the past life, and they're merely put together in the process of the pregnancy in the mother's womb, and the realization comes out, and now we have to live it. But we don't know what we programmed in, and this is the constant surprise. If we knew what we had programmed into this body before we came in, we would not do anything. Since we don't know, this is what surprises us. And if we knew what to do before we came in, carried in memory with us, we will sit down and just be happy, knowing that everything will fall into place. Then what would happen? People get bored with you because you know it all. So in spite of knowing it all, you can't please anybody. And in fact, that you don't know it all, you still can't please yourself and anybody. So the principle is surprise. The art of learning to live with the constant surprise. If you knew it all, you wouldn't do anything. You'd sit there just knowing it's going to happen, and that's it. And then after a while you become a freak. And since you don't know it, what's going to happen, this is the surprise, this is the challenge, this is the anguish, but this is the joy at the same time. Because when it does happen, you are joyful. It could be worse in your mind. See, it could always turn out worse, but since it didn't turn out worse, you're happy. That is the whole essence of the existence. The divine law puts us in that position to learn that lesson. Meditation is to help us to stabilize ourselves so that we can live moment to moment without the anguish, without the tension, without the insecurities and the fears. And the only real security we have in this physical frame that is made up of five elements is love. That's the only security you have. Loving the Lord audible life current with all of your mind, with all of your strength, with your whole being and soul, and your heart. That's all you really have. That's all everybody has. But this is not what everybody wants. And this is not what everybody is expecting to hear. Simply because the mind is looking for something tangible in this physical world as a sort of an anchorage to identify with it. And since there is nothing in this physical world that is tangible to identify with, the mind does not want that. The mind feels cheated. So it searches and searches. It even searches for human form. And what does the human form say? The Father in me doeth everything. I of myself cannot do anything. The form itself tells us, don't rely on it. Rely on the God in you. Rely on the love inside. Rely on the spirit. Learn to rely on the intangible force within yourself. Learn to place more emphasis on that. Put more trust in that force. The mind wants something to relate to what that force should look like. And the only thing that we have that the mind could be satisfied with is a saint, spiritual teacher. He's supposed to be the embodiment of that love. And that is what the mind is searching for. And even the teacher will tell us, call no man master save the Lord which is in you. Learn to realize your own God self. Learn to master yourself. Learn to experience your own God realization. Make the attempt to realize that. So meditation is a direct contact between you and the God self. Between that restless state and the state of peace and tranquility. All things are working through you by that grace. And once you realize it, it falls in place. The only reason why we can't seem to get along with it is that we are impatient. If we knew the exact timing of how each thing will fall into place mathematically before it does happen, we never do anything. But because we don't know the exact timing, how it mathematically falls into place, the surprise element is what makes us reach out. And this is what gives us the strength, it gives us the love, gives us the devotion, keeps us humble. The humbleness, the humility, is the anticipation, the not knowing. And Jesus will put it another way, he says, meekly wait, and don't murmur, don't grumble. Be patient, wait, watch, listen, feel. This is the hardest attitude to develop. But meditation is the only process you have. And the only way you can make it work is by hallowing the name inside. Repeating the name inside and listening to the sound currents and seeing the light. And this puts you in the attentive mood, it puts you in the receptive mood, and it allows you to become patient for the first time. Patience is not an easy process to develop. It carries a great deal of frustration with it, a great deal of anxieties, a great deal of disappointments. But because these challenges exist, this is what makes patience a real experience. Otherwise, patience would be an unreal experience. It would be imaginative. Because we go through these traumatic conditions in our lives, patience become a real thing. After a while, you find that you can handle situations over and over of the same nature much more calmly than you did before when you first encountered them. And this is the process that is being applied. The process is to discover how patient you can be by constantly putting you to the test, putting you under the exposure of it. When you think you're going fine and there's nothing to oppose your mind, that's the time you're going to be tested, and that's the time when the process is going to work. That particular condition is going to come there to test you. Now, 10 months ago, that same thing might be there and you may flare up. 10 months after that same condition comes back, you don't flare up. You begin to seem to have more self-control over the situation. You take it with much more ease. This is the patience. This is the growth. This is the reality. And every day you will discover that that's what you're getting stronger in and nothing else. You're getting stronger in the ability to handle shock, to handle confrontation, to live with confrontation, to grow with confrontation. And that is patience, and that is the faith. That is the confidence that this life principle that sustains you is flowing through you for the first time. And you have the confidence in it that things will work out. Now, we can give the credit for many things, but the credit still goes back to the Divine Self. That higher nature that works in everything, that's where the final credit goes to. When we surrender to it and we accept it, it flows through us without interruption. The experience brings us joy. It brings us harmony. And the only way we can vouch for it, we gotta live it. We can't say it by reading it, because we wouldn't know what it is to feel it. But when we feel it and live it, then we can vouch for it. And by living it, we can pass it or transfer it to another person who is searching for it. Each one of us is giving a portion of this faith, or confidence, or certitude of life to another by living it. When they ask for it, they can feel it, they can experience it, they can recognize it. And this is what you're really getting down to. You're getting down to your conscience. How to live with your conscience. Not your consciousness. Your consciousness plays games with you all the time. Every dualistic movement is in your consciousness. But your conscience is the only thing that you can fall back on and really feel secure. And that state of security is humility. Your conscience makes you humble all the time. Whenever you confront your conscience, you are forced to be humble. And a meditation exposes this within you pretty fast. If you got doubts about your humility, confront your conscience. You learn how fast it works. The path of the masters is very simple. It's based on action. It's not based on writing, it's not based on reading or talking, it's based on action. And the journey begins here at the point above the eye, at the eye center, of watching, hallowing the name, and listening to the sound currents. The sound currents are ultrasonic. The light inside carries the radiant form of the masters. That radiant form of that Divine Self is inside, and you have to see it. We can't imagine it. It's there. It exists. In spite of ourselves that we don't even know it exists, it's there. And the only proof we have is to experience it. Like somebody telling you what a mango tastes like. But until you put a piece of mango in your mouth, you would never know what a mango tastes like. Equally true, until you see the radiant form inside, you would not know what the radiant form really is all about. Equally, when you read the term, when two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. Not until you can actually see that radiant form, it doesn't mean a single thing to you. The radiant form of a master or saint is the evidence you have of your meditative life. And you have to work to see it. You have to work to hear that sankara. And the evidence comes from effort. Have any questions? I'm glad to answer them. Yes.
On one hand, you were teaching about eating different things different times of the day.
Yes.
And on the other hand, you know, a little while ago, you said eventually the best thing to become is kind of a fruitarian or whatever. How could you?
Nature has designed fruits to be eaten all times of the day. Yes, she has provided fruits for every period of the day. In the morning, she has provided fruits that grow on the trees. And in the middle of the day, she has provided fruit that grow on the vine, on the ground. Well, let's give for example. On the trees, you have your apples, your pears, your peaches, and so forth. And you have your citrus fruits. And in the middle of the day, you have all your melons, your cantaloupes, your berries and strawberries. And at evening time, she provides you the cactus family pineapple. So by her own design, and by the way she grows them in that design, she has already set up your pattern of spirituality for you by making you a fruitarian. Protein is in the air. Protein is in the air. Yes. Protein is in the air. The highest protein you have is in the fruit nut. The nut itself has the highest protein. Excuse me for a second. Nuts provide you the protein you need. They're in the air. And your seeds provide you the protein again. You'll notice that protein is the building block of the body. And the archetypal nature of the Creator places the pattern in the building block. So the building block carries the pattern that builds your body. So the building block of the plant is in the seed. So the nut would be the ideal location and source of protein. And if you were to eat from the three periods of the day, the very same seeds and nuts, you would have all the protein you need. Now the animal gets the protein from eating the plant life and incorporates it in his own body and synthesizes it for his own use. And we turn around and eat the animal to get his protein, which is second-hand protein. What we're actually eating from the animal is the amino acids that are necessary for the body, which are all brought together by his ingestion process. Now, he eats one type of food to produce this whole process. We have to eat, in the three periods of the day, the various types of protein to make this ingestion process bring out all the amino acids, and we can get all of them from the three periods of the day. Fruits up in the trees in the ground, high off the ground, those on the surface and those under. They are brought together for the first time in the human body and they are ingested and they have the amino acids. So we are getting our amino acids and protein in the 3 periods of the day from the 3 types of food. Yes, you can live on fruits eventually, but do not advocate this at the start of your spiritual growth. You have committed a karma a long time ago by being involved in the earth process, in the water process, in the fire process, in the air process, and the ether process. Let alone you have violated the sun process and the light process. So you have 7 karmas to work out. And you just can't up and change over and master all these karmas, because these are where your karmas come from. They come from these violation of these 7 forces. We are freed from the 5 at the point of the eyebrow when we keep our minds here. We help to diminish the pull of them. And so we live on the light and the sun. And that helps us to work out and cancel out the commitments to the 5. Of earth, water, fire, air, ether. Now, plants utilize water and the earth. The birds utilize water, earth, and fire. Seafood, they also utilize the earth, water, and the fire. And the birds also utilize the air, because they fly. Animals utilize the air because they walk around and breathe with their lungs. Only man utilizes ether, that is the conscious wavelengths of his consciousness. And man at one time was a cannibal, therefore he violated that too by eating his fellow man. He ate the ether, he broke the ether laws. Now he come to the point, he's got to make compensation. Man has to make compensation for all those laws. Man has to make compensation for all those laws that he broke at one time. And therefore he's forced to go back through the process of elimination. Now, we go up gradually by the elimination of certain types of food from our dietary patterns, until we're competent to handle those of a higher nature. Since we've been eating flesh products over the years and we brought it to a society where it is predominant, we have to slowly rid ourselves of that. We can't do it overnight. We have to make the adjustments. And we begin with quantity, then type. And that way, we are ridding the system of the poisons and the toxins that are being built up in the body from the wrong eating. And we will find that a famous quotation will come to us from the scriptures that say, it's not what you eat that defiles you, but what comes out of you will defile you. This has nothing to do with nutrition. It has to do with consciousness. We eat water, fire, earth, air, ether, the very 5 forces that constitute our mechanism. But what comes out of us is ether all the time. Thought energy that is misapplied in the form of language. It's coming out from the sound currents. If you want to say something to somebody, you still have to use the etheric energy. You still have to draw from the sound waves. And that's the audible life current. Therefore, every word that we utter is an expended energy from the audible life current to which we are accounted for. Therefore, we are then liable for the manifestation of our thoughts. A friend there went towards California not too long ago. He's sitting there in the back, Mr. Kimlicko. And he has often heard me talk about the power of words. And he had some experiences to see what really words do in human lives versus what people eat. Frank, you'd like to relate a little story to them?
I went to a concert at Stanford University, and a family of four guitarists were playing. And the concert was a success. Everybody was happy. There were about 20,000 people there.
For projecting the thought out. But I would not advise her to eat a piece of ham. Because the animal nature would make her say such thought patterns. The very substance would produce the thought patterns. The mind drops down. It doesn't stay up. Yes.
Can you give an idea of how much quantity or something like that is received or things like that? Normal average size people have to eat to get all the proteins that they need during the day. I mean, that's one thing I'm always different. People say you're vegetarian. Well, where do you get your protein? How much protein do you get for, let's say, so many ounces of almonds or something like that? Like how many ounces of almonds do you need to eat to get your normal amount of protein for the day?
Let's take a rational measurement. How many pounds of steak do you have to eat to get protein for your daily requirement?
I guess it's 6 ounces.
The minimum requirement of meat is 4.5 ounces of meat you have to eat. So 6 ounces of meat to give you your minimum requirement of protein from the animal kingdom. Now, one avocado has the equivalent to 1 pound of steak in protein. That's just one avocado. Now, 4 almonds has already got 6 ounces of meat. The content protein of 6 ounces of meat can be found in 4 almonds. In just 4 almonds, you'll find the same protein content that is equivalent to 6 ounces of meat. An ounce and a half of cheese. Just an ounce and a half of cheese that they stick in. You know, when they slice cheese to put it on a cheeseburger, they don't give you an ounce. They give you one slice. It's just about nearly a half an ounce or a quarter of 3/4. That has got almost the protein content of 2 ounces of beef. So when we say protein from meat, in the true essence of the thing, it takes a whole lot of meat to give you protein than other substances that are providing protein. The folly is not in the protein. That is the wrong communication. It's the amino acids in the flesh products that tend to bond the body or work in the body. You will have them now in the flesh product, in one flesh product. Whereas the amino acids that will be required from the vegetable kingdom have to be taken from different types of food to give you the one bonding. If you kill a cow, it eat vegetable or grass to make the protein into its system and bond it with the amino acids. So the amino acids that you take in from eating the flesh is what are complete now for the first time. So you have more amino acids coming into your system that is required by the system by eating one type of food, which would be a piece of steak. Whereas to get that same quantity of amino acids, you may have to eat 4 almonds, 1 avocado, 2 bananas, a piece of melon, or pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, peanuts, to give you the amino acid, not the protein content, the amino acid. Now, nature has designed the amino acids to be gotten in total by the 3 periods of the day from the way the food grows, so that you do get the total amino acids along with your protein. So if you eat the fruits and nuts in the morning, you have certain protein with certain amino acids. If you eat the vegetable and the seeds in the middle of the day, your sesame seeds, your pumpkin seeds, your sunflower seeds, you get another type of protein with their amino acids. Now, at night time, you eat the peanut butter, and you eat the melon or the pineapple, you get in the protein and you get in the amino acids of another type of food, in the carrots. But the sum total of all the meals in the whole day adds up to the sum total of amino acids that you would find out in one piece of steak.
Then you're saying it's not necessary to take this combination of amino acids at the same time?
No, you could not take them in all at one time because the body doesn't handle it properly at one time. If you eat a piece of meat with the amino acids, number one, your body is not designed to digest meat. So how could it handle the amino acids properly? It will decompose by intestinal heat. Meat products do not digest in the human intestines. Otherwise, the hydrochloric acid in your own intestines would digest your own intestines for you. And soon you'd have no intestines left. You see? Your own intestinal tract is tissue, like flesh, like a cow's flesh. And if the acids that are going to really digest beef or chicken or fish, then it will first digest the container in which it's kept in. It will digest your own tissues. It is a known fact, it cannot digest tissues. Your intestinal tract is not designed by nature to digest tissues. Tissues decompose or rot by the intestinal heat when it's chewed and put down in there, and goes through the decomposition by heat. There is no internal digestion going on. Digestion would have to occur in the chemistry of breaking it down into a certain substance where it is precipitated into the mechanism to nourish it. Tissues don't do that. They can't be taken in. The few minerals that are taken in is overweight with the poisons that are being put out by the toxins and the fermentation. So you have more fermentation and more toxins thrown off by the decomposition of the tissues that you put inside in comparison to the amount of nourishment you get. You have now to generate antibodies by your own tissues, by your own organs, to offset the breakdown that is being produced by the toxins. That's not a tissue. So your body is rejecting the tissue.
Is that what one of the toxins
from? Yes, because they do not match up. Yes?
I'm thinking about what you said about the heart transplant.
Yes.
If the content of all of the organs is determined by past karma.
The tissues have a certain way of being measured, just like your own personal tissue. They come in grades. They are identified in grades and different formation of the chromosomes and the hormones. Now, if they don't match up, it's like weaving. If they don't match up, if the two material don't match up, you can't have a bonding. They don't lock into each other.
But the heart that comes from one body has one karmic pattern.
Yes.
It's built into each cell.
Yes.
And you're attempting to force that karmic pattern onto another person.
All right.
And
so
therefore, it will fail.
That's
if
why
the master could somehow touch the body and cause a magnetic adjustment. then it would take.
That's why they're not taking.
Yeah, but obviously other things take, and our heart.
Yes, the others will take, but the heart is not taking. The heart does not take. The heart is the only organ that refuses to take.
So as a man thinks in his heart, so is he, and you can't change what that soul is supposed to be in this life by swapping hearts around.
It'll only work for a little while, then the individual passes on. It doesn't stay too long. You may live a couple of days, and then it goes off, it shuts down.
There was an article in Reader's Digest claiming that researchers have found that the memory of a bell ringing in the head of a rat actually changes 6 amino acids.
Yes.
So by eating animal protein, not animal protein, but meat, taking an animal amino acid, hence animal memory patterns, and if they're assimilated, they're built into our own memory pattern.
Okay, you're only verifying a statement in your scripture. The Lord looked down upon his creation and saw men had eaten of the animal kingdom and became worse than the beast of the field. Worse than the beast of the field. That means he had become into his system the electrical patterns. The electrical nature of the animal kingdom has suddenly taken over the electrical nature of the animal world and taken over it now into the human world and dominating it. So he's becoming worse than the beast. These are being transferred now electrically. Therefore, he's acting worse than the beast. Therefore, he says, I will destroy these people now. They are worse than the beast. There could not be any such thing occurring in your creation if man at that one time incorporated the animal kingdom into himself. Now, the yogis tell us this. The saints tell us this. The reason why the meat is not ideal for the human system, it's flesh, all right. There are only two flesh forms in this universe, the man flesh and the animal flesh. The human flesh or the man flesh carries the audible life current in it. It rejects the animal flesh because it is not ideal for the sun current to remain in. Therefore, it cannot digest it. It cannot become one. The two cannot become one. Therefore, it is decomposing and is thrown off. Now, the electrical nature of the human kingdom is of a higher frequency than the electrical nature of the animal kingdom. And when we allow this body to be clogged up by the residues of the animal kingdom, then our electrical nature goes into a discharge, and we then take on the propensities, the traits, the animalisms, and all the different qualifications of the animal into our system. And then those glandular forces within the endocrine makeup become highly charged, that makes us act like the animal. For the first time now, we have the animal tendencies, and the behavior of the animal tendencies predominate us. Now, we have an example, many examples in your Bible, but which is a good typical one is of a disciple, like Peter, who was with his master, and his master passed on. He went up one day on a rooftop to meditate in the middle of the day, and he saw a sheet where all these creatures were coming in for food. And he said, these things are unclean. But then he heard a voice, he didn't know which voice it was, saying, everything I made is clean. But didn't say, go ahead and eat. He later on partake of the animal kingdom. And in so doing, the electrical nature dominated him. At a later date, when they were building a commune, there was a man and a wife who was put some money into the community pot to build the commune. Peter knew that this man had much more than he had actually put in the box, and therefore he called down his consciousness on the man and said, you should be dead for doing such an act. Both the man and his wife fell dead, because the animal nature was so strong in dominating the electrical nature of the man part in Peter that it caused the energy to trigger off, killing the man and the woman. It took him a long time to overcome that animal nature, because he still carried it in hostility. At a later date, he saw Paul lecturing in a room, and everybody was listening to him, Romans and Greeks, and he thought to himself that he was the elect one who should be teaching the master's work. And here, nobody was listening to him, they were listening to Paul. So he walked out in anger. Passing a blind man, he heard a blind man said, "Why don't you heal me?" He paid no attention to the man because of the anger that was boiling up in him. The animal nature was so strong. But then when he began to reflect upon the true purpose of his existence, then the change occurred back in him. He overcome the animal nature, and he turned around to go back into the room, and a shadow fell upon the blind man, and the blind man was healed. This is what we're talking about, how the nature, how the electrical frequencies can change from within. Yes?
I hear you say one time you had a theory that 7 omelets a day, that's all you need.
At one time you could have eaten 3 to 5 almonds. You understand? It was a preventative for cancer by Edward Casey. Now, in Casey's time, we did not have all the pollution and all the tension in the atmosphere. So we find that the quantity allocated that time is insufficient now, because of the food additives that are in the food. The system is not coping with it. So we have to eat a little more of it to get that reaction. But you find that almonds are good. Better than almonds would be apricots, the pits from the apricot. You see, at the time when Casey was giving this reading to the people that was asking for it, he was not aware of the apricot. The apricot has more effect now than the almond, even the apricot oil. Well, the peach and the almond are related. It's the prussic acid in both that is what that's needed. See, the prussic acid in the almond and the prussic acid in the peach is what is needed in the body at the time as a preventative. It's not a curative, it's a preventative. Well, you can safely eat as much as you want.
I read this book called 100.
Yeah.
It said it's not safe for the human.
How many apricots you think you would want to eat after you eat one mouthful? The taste alone don't make you want to eat too much. So I would say your best bet is to take a teaspoon of apricot oil.
And you get it,
they have apricot oil, it's squeezed from the apricot seed.